As yet it had no window shutters or doors, so the gaps in the walls had been temporarily covered with hurdles, wood frames filled in with woven reeds. The front entrance was thus blocked, but Merthyn took Elizabeth to the back, where there was a temporary wooden door with a lock. Merthyn's 16-year-old assistant, Jimmy, was in the kitchen, guarding the place from thieves. He was a superstitious boy, always crossing himself and throwing salt over his shoulder. He was sitting on a bench in front of a big fire, but he looked anxious.
"Hello, master," he said. "Now that you're here, may I go and get my dinner? Lol Turner was supposed to bring it, but he hasn't come."
"Make sure you're back before it gets dark."
"Thank you."
He hurried off. Merthyn stepped through the doorway to the interior of the house. "Four rooms downstairs," he said, showing her. She was incredulous. What will they use them all for? Kitchen, parlour, dining room, and hall. There was no staircase yet, but Merthyn climbed a ladder to the upper floor, and Elizabeth followed. "Four bedrooms," he said, as she reached the top. "Who will live here?" "Dick and his wife, his son Danny and his wife, and his daughter, who probably won't remain single forever." Most Kingsbridge families lived in one room, and all slept side by side on the floor. Parents, children, grandparents, and in-laws. Elizabeth said, "This place has more rooms than a palace." It was true. A nobleman with a big entourage might still live in two rooms, a bedchamber for himself and his wife, and a great hall for everyone else. But Merthyn had now designed several houses for wealthy Kingsbridge merchants, and the luxury they all craved was privacy. It was a new trend, he thought. "I suppose there will be glass in the windows," Elizabeth said.
"Yes."
That was another trend. Merthyn could remember the time when there was no glazier in Kingsbridge, just an itinerant who called every year or two. Now the city had a resident glazier. They returned to the ground floor. Elizabeth sat on Jimmy's bench in front of the fire and warmed her hands. Merthyn sat beside her. "I'll build a house like this for myself one day," he said, "in a big garden with fruit trees." To his surprise, she leaned her head on his shoulder.
"What a nice dream," she said.
They both stared into the fire. Her hair tickled Merthyn's cheek. After a moment, she laid a hand on his knee. In the silence, he could hear her breathing and his own and the crackle of burning logs.
"In your dream, who's in the house?" she said.
"I don't know."
"Just like a man. I can't see my house, but I know who's in it. A husband, some babies, my mother, an elderly parent-in-law, and three servants.
Men and women have different dreams." She lifted her head, looked at him, and touched his face.
"And when you put them together, you have a life."
She kissed his mouth. He closed his eyes. He remembered the soft touch of her lips from years ago. Her mouth lingered on his for just a moment. Then she drew back. He felt oddly detached, as if he were watching himself from a corner of the room. He did not know how he felt. He looked at her and saw again how lovely she was. He asked himself what was so striking about her, and realized immediately that everything was in harmony, like the parts of a beautiful church. Her mouth, her chin, her cheekbones, and her forehead were just as he would have drawn them if he had been God creating a woman. She looked back at him with calm blue eyes.
"Touch me," she said.
She opened her cloak. He took her breast gently in his hand. He remembered doing this, too. Her breasts were firm and flat against her chest. Her nipple hardened immediately to his touch, betraying her calm demeanor.
"I want to be in your dream house," she said,
and she kissed him again. She was not acting on the spur of the moment. Elizabeth never did. She had been thinking about this. While he had been casually visiting her, enjoying her company without thinking any farther, she had been imagining their life together. Perhaps she had even planned this scene. That would explain why her mother had left them with an excuse about a pie. He had almost spoiled her plan by proposing to show her Dick Brewer's house, but she had improvised. There was nothing wrong with such an unemotional approach. She was a reasoning person. It was one of the things he liked about her. He knew that passions burned, nonetheless, beneath the surface. What seemed wrong was his own lack of feeling. It was not his way to be coolly rational about women, quite the reverse. When he had felt love, it had taken him over, making him feel rage and resentment as well as lust and tenderness. Now he felt interested, flattered, and titillated, but he was not out of control. She sensed that his kiss was lukewarm and drew back. He saw the ghost of an emotion on her face, fiercely suppressed, but he knew there was fear behind the mask. She was so poised by nature that it must have cost her a lot to be so forward, and she dreaded rejection. She drew away from him, stood up, and lifted the skirt of her dress. She had long, shapely legs, covered with nearly invisible fine blonde hair. Although she was tall and slim, her body widened just below the hips in a delightfully womanly way. His gaze homed in helplessly on the delta of her sex. Her hair was so fair that he could see through it to the pale swelling of the lips and the delicate line between them. He looked up to her face and read desperation there. She had tried everything, and she saw that it had not worked. Merthyn said, "I'm sorry." She dropped her skirts. "Listen," he said, "I think..." She interrupted him. "Don't speak." Her desire was turning to anger. "Whatever you say now will be a lie." She was right. He had been trying to formulate some soothing half-truth. He was not feeling well, or Jimmy might be back at any moment. But she did not want to be mollified. She had been rebuffed, and feeble excuses would only make her feel patronized as well. She stared at him, grief struggling with rage on the battleground of her beautiful face. Tears of frustration came to her eyes. "Why not?" she cried. But when he opened his mouth to reply, she said, "Don't answer. It won't be the truth." And again she was right. She turned to go, then came back. "It's Caris," she said, her face working with emotion. "That witch has cast a spell on you. She won't marry you, but no one else can have you. She's evil." At last she walked away. She flung open the door and stepped out. He heard her sob once, then she was gone. Merthyn stared into the fire. "Oh, hell," he said. "There's something I need to explain to you," Merthyn said to Edmund a week later, as they were leaving the cathedral. Edmund's face took on a look of mild amusement that was familiar to Merthyn. "I'm 30 years older than you," the look said, "and you should be listening to me, not giving me lessons. But I enjoy youthful enthusiasm. Besides, I'm not yet too old to learn something." "All right," he said, "but explain it in the bell. I want a cup of wine." They went into the tavern and sat close to the fire. Elizabeth's mother brought their wine, but she stuck her nose in the air and did not talk to them. Edmund said, "Is Sairy angry with you or me?"
"Never mind that," said Merthyn. "Have you ever stood at the edge of the ocean, with your bare feet on the sand, and felt the sea wash over your toes?"
"Of course. All children play in water.
Even I was a boy once." "Do you remember how the action of the waves, flowing in and out, seems to scour the sand from under the edges of your feet, making a little channel?"
"Yes. It's a long time ago, but I think I know what you mean."
"That's what happened to the old wooden bridge. The flowing river scoured the earth from under the central pier."
"How do you know?"
"By the pattern of cracks in the woodwork, just before the collapse."
"What's your point?"
"The river hasn't changed. It will undermine the new bridge just as surely as it did the old, unless we prevent it."
"How?"
"In my drawing, I showed a pile of large, loose stones surrounding each of the piers of the new bridge. They will break up the current and enfeeble its effect.
It's the difference between being tickled by loose thread and being flogged with a tightly woven rope.
How do you know?
I asked Bonaventura about it, immediately after the bridge collapsed, before he went back to London. He said he had seen such piles of stones around the piers of bridges in Italy, and he had often wondered what they were for.
Fascinating. Are you telling me this for general enlightenment, or is there some more specific purpose?
People like Godwin and Elfrick don't understand this, and wouldn't listen if I told them. Just in case Elfrick takes it into his fool head not to follow my design exactly, I want to be sure that at least one person in town knows the reason for the pile of stones.
But one person does. You.
I'm leaving Kingsbridge. That shocked him.
Leaving,
he said.
You.
At that moment, Caris appeared. Don't stay here too long, she said to her father. Aunt Petronilla is preparing dinner. Do you want to join us, Merthyn?
Edmund said, Merthyn's leaving Kingsbridge.
Caris paled. Seeing her reaction, Merthyn felt a jolt of satisfaction. She had rejected him, but she was dismayed to hear that he was leaving town. He immediately felt ashamed of such an unworthy emotion. He was too fond of her to want her to suffer. All the same, he would have felt worse if she had received the news with equanimity.
Why?
She said. There's nothing for me here. What am I going to build? I can't work on the bridge. The town already has a cathedral. I don't want to do nothing but merchants' houses for the rest of my life. In a quiet voice, she said, Where will you go?
Florence. I've always wanted to see the buildings of Italy. I'll ask Bonaventura Caroli for letters of introduction. I might even be able to travel with one of his consignments.
But you own property here in Kingsbridge. I wanted to speak to you about that. Would you manage it for me? You could collect my rents, take a commission, and give the balance to Bonaventura. He can transfer money to Florence by letter.
I don't want a damn commission, she said huffily.
Merthyn shrugged. It's work. You should be paid.
How can you be so cold about it? She said.
Her voice was shrill, and around the parlor of the bell several people looked up. She took no notice.
You'll be leaving all your friends.
I'm not cold about it. Friends are great, but I'd like to get married.
Edmund put in, Plenty of girls in Kingsbridge would marry you. You're not handsome, but you're prosperous, and that's worth more than good looks.
Merthyn smiled wryly. Edmund could be disarmingly blunt. Caris had inherited the trait.
For a while I thought I might marry Elizabeth Clark, he said.
Edmund said,
So did I.
Caris said, She's a cold fish.
No, she's not.
But when she asked me, I backed off.
Caris said, Oh, so that's why she's so bad-tempered lately.
Edmund said, And why her mother wouldn't look at Merthyn.
Why did you refuse her?
Caris asked. There's only one woman in Kingsbridge I could marry, and she doesn't want to be anyone's wife.
But she doesn't want to lose you.
Merthyn became angry.
What should I do?
He said. His voice was loud, and people around them stopped their conversations to listen.
Godwin has fired me, you've rejected me, and my brother is an outlaw. In God's name, why should I stay here?
I don't want you to go, she said.
That's not enough,
he shouted. The room was silent now. Everyone there knew them. The landlord, Paul Bell, and his curvy daughter, Bessie. The grey-haired barmaid, Sarah, Elizabeth's mother. Bill Watkin, who had refused to employ Merthyn. Edward Butcher, the notorious adulterer. Jake Chepstow, Merthyn's tenant. Friar Murdo, Matthew Barber, and Mark Webber. They all knew the history of Merthyn and Caris, and they were fascinated by the quarrel. Merthyn did not care. Let them listen. He said furiously, I'm not going to spend my life hanging around you like your dog Scrap, waiting for your attention. I'll be your husband, but I won't be your pet.
All right, then, she said in a small voice.
Her sudden change of tone surprised him, and he was not sure what she meant.
All right, what?
All right. I'll marry you.
For a moment, he was too shocked to speak. Then he said suspiciously, Do you mean it? She looked up at him at last and smiled shyly.
Yes, I mean it, she said. Just ask me.
All right. He took a deep breath.
Will you marry me? Yes, I will, she said.
Edmund shouted, Hurrah! Everyone in the tavern cheered and clapped. Merthin and Karis started laughing.
Will you really? He said. Yes.
They kissed. Then he put his arms around her and squeezed as hard as he could. When he let her go, he saw that she was crying. Some wine for my betrothed, he called out. A barrel, in fact. Give everyone a cup so they can all drink our health. Coming right up, said the landlord, and they all cheered again. A week later, Elizabeth Clark became a novice nun. Chapter 40 Ralph and Alan were miserable. They were living on venison and cold water, and Ralph found himself dreaming about food he would normally scorn. Onions, apples, eggs, milk. They slept in a different place every night, always lighting a fire. They each had a good cloak, but it was not enough out in the open, and they woke shivering every dawn. They robbed any vulnerable people they met on the road, but most of the loot was either paltry or useless. Ragged clothes, animal fodder, and money, which would buy nothing in the forest. Once they stole a big barrel of wine. They rolled it 100 yards into the woods, drank as much as they could, and fell asleep. When they woke up, hungover and ill-tempered, they realized they could not take the 3/4 full barrel with them, so they just left it there. Ralph thought nostalgically of his former life. The manor house, the roaring fires, the servants, the dinners. But in his realistic moments, he knew he did not want that life either. It was too dull. That was probably why he had raped the girl. He needed excitement. After a month in the forest, Ralph decided they had to get organized. They needed a base where they could build some kind of shelter and store food, and they had to plan their robberies so that they stole items that would be really valuable to them, such as warm clothing and fresh food. Around the time he was coming to this realization, their wanderings brought them to a range of hills, a few miles from Kingsbridge. Ralph recalled that the hillsides, bleak and bare in winter, were used for summer grazing by shepherds who had built rough stone shelters in the folds of the landscape. As adolescents, he and Merthin had discovered these crude buildings while out hunting, and had lit fires and cooked the rabbits and partridges they shot with their bows. Even in those days, he recalled, he had craved the thrill of the hunt, chasing and shooting a terrified creature, finishing it off with a knife or club, the ecstatic sense of power that came from taking a life. No one would come here until the new season's grass was thick. The traditional day was Whitsunday, also the opening day of the Fleece Fair, still 2 months away. Ralph selected a hut that looked sturdy, and they made it their home. There were no doors or windows, just a low entrance, but there was a hole in the roof to let smoke out, and they lit a fire and slept warm for the first time in a month. Proximity to Kingsbridge gave Ralph another bright idea. The time to rob people, he realized, was when they were on their way to market. They were carrying cheeses, flagons of cider, honey, oat cakes, all the things that were produced by villagers and needed by townspeople, and by outlaws. Kingsbridge Market was on a Sunday. Ralph had lost track of the days of the week, but he found out by asking a travelling friar, before robbing him of 3 shillings and a goose. On the following Saturday, he and Alan made camp not far from the road to Kingsbridge, and stayed awake all night by their fire. At dawn, they made their way to the road and lay in wait. The first group to come along were carting fodder. Kingsbridge had hundreds of horses and very little grass, so the town constantly needed supplies of hay. However,
It was no use to Ralph. Griff and Fletch had no end of grazing in the forest. Ralph was not bored waiting. Preparing an ambush was like watching a woman get undressed. The longer the anticipation, the more intense the thrill. Soon afterwards they heard singing. The hairs on the back of Ralph's neck stood up. It sounded like angels. The morning was hazy, and when he first saw the singers, they seemed to have halos. Alan, obviously thinking the same as Ralph, even gave a sob of fear. But it was only the weak winter sun lighting the mist behind the travellers. They were peasant women, each carrying a basket of eggs, hardly worth robbing. Ralph let them go by without revealing himself. The sun rose a little higher. Ralph began to worry that soon the road would become sufficiently crowded with market-goers to make robbery difficult. Then along came a family, a man and woman in their 30s, with 2 adolescent children, a boy and a girl. They were vaguely familiar. No doubt he had seen them at Kingsbridge Market during the years he lived there. They carried an assortment of goods. The husband had a heavy basket of vegetables on his back. The wife balanced on her shoulder a long pole bearing several live chickens, trussed. The boy had a heavy ham on his shoulder, and the girl a crock that probably contained salted butter. Ralph's mouth watered at the thought of ham. The excitement rose in his guts, and he gave Alan a nod. As the family drew level, Ralph and Alan came out of the bushes at a run. The woman screamed, and the boy gave a shout of fear. The man tried to shrug off his basket, but before it fell from his shoulders, Ralph ran him through, his sword piercing the man's abdomen under the ribs and then rising up. The man's scream of agony was cut off abruptly as the point of the sword penetrated his heart. Alan swung at the woman and cut through most of her neck, so that blood spurted from her severed throat in a sudden red jet. Exhilarated, Ralph turned to the son. The lad was quick to react. He had already dropped his ham and drawn a knife. While Ralph's weapon was still on the upswing, the boy darted close and stabbed him. It was an unprofessional blow, too wild to do much damage. The knife completely missed Ralph's chest, but the point caught in the flesh of his upper right arm, and the sudden agonizing pain made him drop his sword. The boy turned and ran away, going in the direction of Kingsbridge. Ralph looked at Alan. Before turning to the girl, Alan finished off the mother, and the delay almost cost him his life. Ralph saw the girl throw her crock of butter at Alan. Either accurate or lucky, she hit him square on the back of the head, and Alan fell to the ground as if poleaxed. Then she ran after her brother. Ralph stooped, picked up his sword in his left hand, and gave chase. They were young and fleet, but he had long legs, and he soon gained on them. The boy looked over his shoulder and saw Ralph coming close. To Ralph's astonishment, the lad stopped, turned, and came running back at him, screaming, knife raised in his fist. Ralph stopped running and lifted his sword. The boy ran at him, then stopped outside his reach. Ralph stepped forward and lunged, but it was a feint. The boy dodged the blow, then, thinking to catch Ralph off balance, tried to step inside his guard and stab him at close quarters. But that was exactly what Ralph was expecting. He stepped nimbly back, stood on the balls of his feet, and thrust his sword precisely into the boy's throat, pushing it through until the point came out of the back of his neck. The boy fell dead, and Ralph withdrew his sword, pleased with the accuracy and efficiency of the death blow. He looked up to see the girl disappearing into the distance. He saw immediately that he could not catch her on foot, and by the time he fetched his horse, she would be in Kingsbridge. He turned and looked back. To his surprise, Alan was struggling to his feet. "I thought she'd killed you," Ralph said. He wiped his sword on the dead boy's tunic, sheathed his blade, and clamped his left hand over the wound in his right arm, trying to stop the bleeding. "My head hurts like Satan," Alan replied. "Did you kill them all?" "The girl got away. Do you think she knew us?" "She might know me. I've seen this family before." "In that case, we're now branded as murderers." Ralph shrugged. Better to hang than starve. He looked at the three bodies. All the same, let's get these peasants off the road before someone comes along. With his left hand, he dragged the man to the edge of the road. Alan picked up the body and threw it into the bushes. They did the same with the woman and the boy. Ralph made sure the corpses were not visible to passers-by. The blood on the road was already darkening to the color of the mud into which it was soaking. Ralph cut a strip off the woman's dress and tied it around the cut in his arm. It still hurt, but the flow of blood was less. He felt the slight depression that always followed a fight, like the sadness after sex. Alan began to collect up the loot. "A nice haul," he said. "Ham, chickens, butter." He looked into the basket the man had been carrying. "And onions! Last year's, of course, but still good." "Old onions taste better than no onions. My mother says that." As Ralph bent to pick up the buttercrock that had felled Alan, he felt a sharp iron point stick into his arse. Alan was in front of him, dealing with the trussed chickens. Ralph said, "Who?" A harsh voice said, "Don't move." Ralph never obeyed such instructions. He sprang forward, away from the voice, and spun around. Six or seven men had materialized from nowhere. He was bewildered, but he managed, left-handed, to draw his sword. The man nearest him, who presumably had prodded him, raised his sword to fight, but the others were grabbing the loot, snatching chickens and fighting over the ham. Alan's sword flashed in defense of his chickens as Ralph engaged with his antagonist. He realized that another group of outlaws was trying to rob him. He was filled with indignation. He had killed people for this stuff, and now they wanted to take it from him. He felt no fear, only anger. He attacked his opponent with the energy of outrage, despite being forced to fight left-handed. Then an authoritative voice said loudly, "Put away your blades, you fools!" All the newcomers stood still. Ralph held his sword at the ready, suspicious of a trick, and looked towards the voice. He saw a handsome man in his 20s with something of the nobility about him. He wore clothes that looked expensive but were filthy dirty, a cloak of Italian scarlet covered with leaves and twigs, a rich brocade coat marked with what appeared to be food stains, and hose of a rich chestnut leather, scratched and muddy. "It amuses me to steal from thieves," the newcomer said. "It's not a crime, you see." Ralph knew he was in a tight spot, but all the same, he was intrigued. "Are you the one they call Tam Hiding?" he said. "There were stories of Tam Hiding when I was a child," the man replied. "But every now and again someone comes along to act the part, like a monk impersonating Lucifer in a mystery play. You're not a common type of outlaw, nor are you. I'm guessing that you're Ralph Fitzgerald." Ralph nodded. "I heard about your escape, and I've been wondering when I'd run into you." Tam looked up and down the road. "We happened upon you by accident. What made you choose this spot?" "I picked the day and time first. It's Sunday, and at this hour the peasants are taking their produce to market in Kingsbridge, which is on this road." "Well, well. 10 years I've been living outside the law, and I never thought of doing that. Perhaps we should team up. Are you going to put your weapon away?" Ralph hesitated, but Tam was unarmed, so he could not see the disadvantage. Anyway, he and Alan were so heavily outnumbered that it would be best to avoid a fight. Slowly he sheathed his sword. "That's better." Tam put an arm around Ralph's shoulders, and Ralph realized they were the same height. Not many people were as tall as Ralph. Tam walked him into the woods, saying, "The others will bring the loot. Come this way. We've got a lot to talk about, you and I." Edmund rapped on the table. "I've called this emergency meeting of the Parish Guild to discuss the outlaw problem," he said. "But, as I'm getting old and lazy, I've asked my daughter to summarize the situation." Caris was a member of the Parish Guild now, by virtue of her success as a manufacturer of scarlet cloth. The new business had rescued her father's fortunes. Numerous other Kingsbridge people were prospering because of it, notably the Webber family. Her father had been able to fulfill his pledge to lend money for the building of the bridge, and in the general upturn, several other merchants had done the same. Bridge building continued apace, supervised now by Alfric, not Merthyn, unfortunately. Her father took little initiative these days. The moments when he was his sharp-witted former self were becoming rarer. She was worried about him, but there was nothing she could do. She felt the rage that had possessed her during her mother's illness. Why was there no help for him? Nobody understood what was wrong. No one could even put a name to his malady. They said it was old age, but he was not yet 50. She prayed he would live to see her wedding. She was going to marry Merthyn in Kingsbridge Cathedral on the Sunday after the Fleece Fair, now just a month away. The wedding of the daughter of the town's alderman would be a big event. There would be a banquet in the Guildhall for the leading citizens, and a picnic in Lover's Field for several hundred more guests. Some days her father would spend hours planning the menus and the entertainment, only to forget everything he had said and start again from scratch the next day. She put that out of her mind and turned her attention to a problem she hoped would be more tractable. In the last month, there has been a big increase in attacks by outlaws, she said. They take place mainly on Sundays, and the victims are invariably people bringing produce to Kingsbridge. She was interrupted by Alfric. It's your fiancé's brother that's doing it, he said. Talk to Merthyn, not us. Caris suppressed a flash of exasperation. Her sister's husband never missed a chance to snipe at her. She was painfully aware of Ralph's likely involvement. It was a cause of agony to Merthyn. Alfric relished that. Dick Brewer said, I think it's Tam hiding. Perhaps it's both, Caris said. I believe that Ralph Fitzgerald, who has some military training, may have joined forces with an existing band of outlaws and simply made them more organized and effective. Fat Betty Baxter, the town's most successful baker, said, Whoever it is, there'll be the ruination of this town. No one comes to market anymore. That was an exaggeration, but attendance at the weekly market was down drastically, and the effects were felt by just about every enterprise in town, from bakeries to brothels. That's not the worst of it, though, Caris said. In 4 weeks' time, we've got the Fleece Fair. Several people here have invested enormous sums of money in the new bridge, which should be ready for use, with a temporary timber roadbed, in time for the opening. Most of us depend on the annual fair for our prosperity. I personally have a warehouse full of costly scarlet cloth to sell. If it gets around that people coming to Kingsbridge are likely to be robbed by outlaws, we may have no customers. She was even more worried than she let herself appear. Neither she nor her father had any cash left. Everything they had was either invested in the bridge or tied up in raw wool and scarlet cloth. The Fleece Fair was their chance to get their money back. If attendance was poor, they would be in deep trouble. Among other things, who would pay for the wedding? She was not the only worried citizen. Rick Silvers, the head of the Jewelers' Guild, said, That would be the third bad year in succession. He was a prim, fussy man, always immaculately dressed. It would finish some of my people, he went on. We do half our year's business at the Fleece Fair. Edmund said, It would finish this town. We can't let it happen. Several others joined in. Caris, who was unofficially presiding, let them grumble. A heightened sense of urgency would predispose them to accept the radical solution she was going to propose. Alfric said, The Sheriff of Shiring ought to do something about it. What's he paid for, if not to keep the peace? Caris said, He can't search the entire forest. He doesn't have enough men. Earl Rowland has. This was wishful thinking, but again Caris let the discussion run, so that when she proposed her solution, they would be aware that there were no real alternatives. Edmund said to Alfric, The Earl won't help us. I've already asked him. Caris, who had in fact written Edmund's letter to Rowland, said, Ralph was the Earl's man, and still is. You notice the outlaws don't attack people going to Shiring Market.
Elfric said indignantly, Those Wagley peasants should never have made a complaint against a squire of the Earl's. Who do they think they are?
Carys was about to respond indignantly, but Betty Baxter beat her to it.
Oh! So you think lords should be allowed to rape anyone they like?
Edmund intervened. That's a different question, he said briskly, showing some of his old authority. It's happened, and Ralph is preying on us. So what are we going to do? The sheriff can't help us, and the Earl won't.
Rick Silvers said, What about Lord William? He took the side of the Wigley people. It's his fault that Ralph's an outlaw.
I asked him, too, Edmund said. He said we're not in his territory.
Rick said, That's the trouble with having the priory as your landlord. What use is a prior when you need protection?
Carys said, Another reason why we are applying to the king for a borough charter. We'd be under royal protection then.
Elfric said, We've got our own constable. What's he doing?
Mark Webber spoke. He was one of the constable's deputies.
We're ready to do whatever's necessary, he said. Just give us the word.
Carys said, No one doubts your bravery, but your role is to deal with troublemakers within the town. John Constable doesn't have the expertise to hunt down outlaws.
Mark, who was close to Carys because he ran her fulling mill at Wigley, was mildly indignant.
Well, who does then?
Carys had been leading the discussion towards this question. As a matter of fact, there is an experienced soldier who is willing to help us, she said. I took the liberty of asking him to come here tonight, and he's waiting in the chapel. She raised her voice.
Thomas, will you join us?
Thomas Langley came out of the little chapel at the end of the hall.
Rick Silvers said skeptically,
A monk?
Before he was a monk, he was a soldier, Carys explained. That's how he lost his arm.
Elfric said grumpily, Guild members' permission should have been sought before he was invited.
No one took any notice, Carys was pleased to see. They were too interested to hear what Thomas would have to say.
You need to form a militia, Thomas began. By all accounts, there are 20 or 30 outlaws in the troop.
That's not many. Most townsmen can use a longbow effectively, thanks to the Sunday morning practice sessions. 100 of you, well prepared and intelligently led, could overcome the outlaws easily.
That's all very well, said Rick Silvers, but we have to find them.
Of course, said Thomas, but I feel sure there is someone in Kingsbridge who knows where they are.
Merthyn had asked the timber merchant, Jake Chepstow, to bring him a piece of slate from Wales, the largest piece he could find. Jake had come back from his next logging expedition with a thin sheet of grey Welsh slate about 4 feet square. Merthyn had encased it in a wooden frame, and he used it for sketching plans. This evening, while Carys was at the parish guild, Merthyn was at his own house on Leper Island, working on a map of the island. Renting parts of it for wharves and warehouses was the least of his ambitions. He foresaw an entire street of inns and shops crossing the island from one bridge to the other. He would construct the buildings himself and rent them to enterprising Kingsbridge traders. It excited him to look into the future of the town and imagine the buildings and streets it was going to need. This was the kind of thing the priory would have done if it had had better leadership. Included in the plan was a new house for him and Carys. This little place would be cosy when they were first married, but they would need more room eventually, especially if they had children. He had marked out a site on the southern shore, where they would get fresh air off the river. Most of the island was rocky, but the patch he had in mind featured a small area of cultivable soil, where he might be able to grow some fruit trees. As he planned the house, he relished the vision of the two of them living side by side, day by day, always. His dream was interrupted by a knock at the door. He was startled. Normally no one came to the island at night, except Carys, and she would not knock.
Who is it?
he called nervously. Thomas Langley came in. "Monks are supposed to be asleep at this time," Merthyn said. "Godwin doesn't know I'm here." Thomas looked at the slate. "You draw left-handed." "Left, all right. It makes no difference. Would you like a cup of wine?" "No, thanks. I'll have to be up for matins in a few hours, so I don't want to get sleepy." Merthyn liked Thomas. There had been a bond between them ever since that day, 12 years ago, when he had promised that if Thomas should die, he would take a priest to the place where the letter was buried. Later, when they had worked together on cathedral repairs, Thomas had always been clear in his instructions and gracious to apprentices. He managed to be sincere about his religious calling without becoming prideful. All men of God should be like that, Merthyn thought. He waved Thomas to a chair by the fire. "What can I do for you?" "It's about your brother. He has to be stopped." Merthyn winced, as if at a sudden stab of pain. "If I could do anything, I would. But I haven't seen him, and when I do, I'm not sure he will listen to me. There was a time when he looked to me for guidance, but I think those days are over." "I've just come from a meeting of the parish guild. They asked me to organize a militia. Don't expect me to be part of it." "No, I didn't come for that purpose." Thomas gave a wry smile. "Your many amazing talents don't actually include military skills." Merthyn nodded ruefully. "Thanks, but there is something you could do to help me, if you would." Merthyn felt uneasy. "Well, ask me." "The outlaws must have a hideout somewhere not far from Kingsbridge. I want you to think about where your brother might be. It's probably a place you both know. A cave, perhaps, or an abandoned verdurous hut in the forest." Merthyn hesitated. Thomas said, "I know you'd hate to betray him, but think of that first family he attacked. A decent, hard-working peasant, his pretty wife, a lad of 14 and a little girl. Now 3 of them are dead, and the little girl has no parents. Even though you love your brother, you have to help us catch him." "I know. Can you think where he might be?" Merthyn was not yet ready to answer the question. "Will you take him alive?" "If I can." Merthyn shook his head. "Not good enough. I need a guarantee." Thomas was silent for a few moments. At last he said, "All right, I'll take him alive. I don't know how, but I'll find a way. I promise." "Thank you." Merthyn paused. He knew he had to do this, but his heart rebelled. After a moment, he forced himself to speak. "When I was about 13, we used to go hunting, often with older boys. We would stay out all day and cook whatever we shot. Sometimes we used to go as far as the Chalk Hills and meet the families who spend the summer up there, grazing sheep. Shepherdesses tend to be quite free and easy. Some would let you kiss them." He smiled briefly. "In winter, when they weren't there, we used their huts for shelter. That might be where Ralph is hiding out." "Thank you," said Thomas. He stood up. "Remember your promise."
"I will."
"You trusted me with a secret 12 years ago."
"I know. I never betrayed you. I realize that.
Now I'm trusting you." Merthyn knew that his words could be interpreted 2 ways, either as a plea for reciprocity or as a veiled threat. That was all right. Let Thomas take it how he wished. Thomas put out his one hand and Merthyn clasped it.
"I'll keep my word," Thomas said. Then he went out.
Ralph and Tam rode side by side up the hill, followed by Alan Fernhill on his horse and the rest of the outlaws on foot. Ralph was feeling good. It had been another successful Sunday morning's work. Spring had arrived, and the peasants were beginning to bring the new season's produce to market. The members of the gang were carrying 6 lambs, a jar of honey, a stoppered jug of cream, and several leather bottles of wine. As usual, the outlaws had suffered only minor injuries, a few cuts and bruises inflicted by the more foolhardy of their victims. Ralph's partnership with Tam had been extraordinarily successful. A couple of hours' easy fighting brought them all they needed for a week of living in luxury. They spent the rest of their time hunting in the day and drinking in the evenings. There were no clod-hopping serfs to badger them about boundary disputes or cheat them of rent. All they lacked were women, and today they had remedied that by kidnapping two plump girls, sisters of about 13 and 14 years. His only regret was that he had never fought for the king. It had been his ambition since boyhood, and he still felt the tug. Being an outlaw was too easy. He could not feel very proud of killing unarmed serfs. The boy in him longed yet for glory. He had never proved to himself and others that he had in him the soul of a true knight. However, he would not allow that thought to lower his spirits. As he breasted the rise that hid the upland pasture where their hideout was, he looked forward to a feast tonight. They would roast a lamb on a spit and drink cream with honey. And the girls. Ralph decided he would make them lie side by side, so that each would see her sister being violated by one man after another. The thought made his heart beat faster. They came within sight of the stone shelters. They would not be able to use these much longer, Ralph reflected. The grass was growing, and the shepherds would be here soon. Easter had been early this year, so Whitsun would come soon after May Day. The outlaws would have to find another base. When he was 50 yards from the nearest hut, he was shocked to see someone walk out of it. He and Tam both reined in, and the outlaws gathered around them, hands on their weapons. The man approached them, and Ralph saw that it was a monk. Tam, beside Ralph, said, "What in the name of heaven?" One sleeve of the monk's robe flapped empty, and Ralph recognized him as Brother Thomas from Kingsbridge. Thomas walked up to them as if meeting them by chance on the main street. "Hello, Ralph," he said. "Remember me?" Tam said to Ralph, "Do you know this man?" Thomas came up on the right side of Ralph's horse and extended his good right arm to shake hands. What the hell was he doing here? On the other hand, what harm could there be in a one-armed monk? Baffled, Ralph reached down and took the proffered hand. Thomas slipped his hand up Ralph's arm and grasped his elbow. Out of the corner of his eye, Ralph saw movement near the stone huts. Glancing up, he saw a man step out through the doorway of the nearest building, closely followed by a second man, then three more. Then he saw that they were pouring out of all the huts and fitting arrows to the tall longbows they carried. He realized that he and his band had been ambushed, but in that moment the grip on his elbow tightened, and with a sudden strong heave he was pulled off his horse. A shout went up from the outlaws. Ralph crashed to the ground, landing on his back. His horse Griff skittered sideways, frightened. As Ralph tried to get up, Thomas fell on him like a tree, flattening him to the ground, and lay on top of him like a lover.
"Lie still, and you won't get killed," he said in Ralph's ear.
Then Ralph heard the sound of dozens of arrows being shot simultaneously from longbows, a deadly swish that was unmistakable, like the sudden wind of a flash thunderstorm. The noise was tremendous. There must have been 100 archers, he thought. They had obviously crammed themselves into the shelters. Thomas's grasping Ralph's arm must have been the signal for them to come out and shoot. He considered fighting Thomas off, and thought better of it. He could hear the cries of the outlaws as the arrows struck home. From ground level he could not see much, but some of his men were drawing their swords. However, they were too far from the archers. If they ran at their enemy, they would be shot down before they could engage. It was a massacre, not a battle. Hooves drummed the earth, and Ralph wondered whether Tam was charging the archers or riding away. Confusion reigned, but not for long. Within moments he could tell that the outlaws were in full retreat. Thomas got off him, pulled a long dagger from under his Benedictine robe, and said,
"Don't even think about drawing your sword."
Ralph stood up. He looked at the archers and recognized many of them. Fat Dick Brewer, Randy Edward Butcher, convivial Paul Bell, grumpy Bill Watkin, timid, law-abiding citizens of Kingsbridge, every one. He had been captured by tradesmen. But that was not the most surprising thing. He looked curiously at Thomas. "You saved my life, monk," he said. "Only because your brother asked me to," Thomas replied crisply. "If it had been up to me, you would have been dead before you hit the ground." The Kingsbridge jail was in the basement of the Guildhall. The pen had stone walls, a dirt floor, and no windows. There was no fire either, and prisoners occasionally died of cold in the winter. But this was May, and Ralph had a wool cloak to keep him warm at night. He also had a few items of furniture, a chair, a bench, and a small table, rented from John Constable and paid for by Merthyn. On the other side of the barred oak door was John Constable's office. On market days and during the fair, he and his deputy sat there, waiting to be summoned to deal with trouble. Alan Fernhill was in the cell with Ralph. A Kingsbridge archer had brought him down with an arrow in the thigh, and although the wound was not serious, he had been unable to run. However, Tam Hiding had got away. Today was their last here. The sheriff was due at midday to take them to Shiring. They had already been sentenced to death in their absence for the rape of Annet, and for the crimes they had committed in that court under the judge's eye, wounding the foreman of the jury, wounding Wulfric, and escaping. When they got to Shiring, they would be hanged. An hour before noon, Ralph's parents brought them dinner, hot ham, new bread, and a jug of strong ale. Merthyn came with them, and Ralph surmised that this was goodbye. His father confirmed it. "We'll not follow you to Shiring," he said. His mother added, "We don't want to see you." She broke down, but he knew what she was going to say. They would not journey to Shiring to see him hang. Ralph drank the ale, but found it difficult to eat. He was going to the gallows, and food seemed pointless. Anyway, he had no appetite. Alan tucked in. He seemed to have no sense of the doom that awaited him. The family sat in an awkward silence. Although these were their last minutes together, no one knew what to say. Maud wept quietly. Gerald looked thunderous, and Merthyn sat with his head in his hands. Alan Fernhill just looked bored. Ralph had a question for his brother. Part of him did not want to ask it, but now he realized that this was his last chance. "When Brother Thomas pulled me off my horse, protecting me from the arrows, I thanked him for saving my life," he said. Looking at his brother, he went on, "Thomas said he did it for you, Merthyn." Merthyn just nodded. "Did you ask him to?" "Yes." "So you knew what was going to happen?" "Yes." "So, how did Thomas know where to find me?" Merthyn did not answer. Ralph said, "You told him, didn't you?" Their father was shocked. "Merthyn," he said, "how could you?" Alan Fernhill said, "You treacherous swine." Merthyn said to Ralph, "You were murdering people, innocent peasants and their wives and children. You had to be stopped." Ralph did not feel angry, somewhat to his surprise. He felt a choking sensation. He swallowed, then said, "But why did you ask Thomas to spare my life? Was it because you preferred that I should hang?" Maud said, "Ralph, don't," and sobbed. "I don't know," Merthyn said. "Perhaps I just wanted you to live a little longer. But you did betray me." Ralph found that he was on the verge of breaking down. Tears seemed to gather behind his eyes, and he felt the pressure in his head. "You betrayed me," he repeated. Merthyn stood up and said angrily, "By God, you deserved it!" Maud said, "Don't fight!" Ralph shook his head sadly. "We're not going to fight," he said. "Those days are over." The door opened and John Constable stepped in. "The sheriff is outside," he announced. Maud put her arms around Ralph and clung to him, weeping. After a few moments, Gerald gently pulled her away.
John walked out, and Ralph followed him. He was surprised not to be tied up or chained. He had escaped once before. Were they not afraid he would do the same again? He walked through the constable's office and out into the open air. His family came behind. It must have been raining earlier, for now bright sunshine reflected off the wet street, and Ralph had to screw up his eyes against the glare. As he adjusted to the light, he recognized his own horse, Griff, saddled ready. The sight gladdened his heart. He took the reins and spoke into the horse's ear.
"You never betrayed me, boy, did you, eh?"
The horse blew its nostrils and stamped, pleased to have its master back. The sheriff and several deputies were waiting, mounted and armed to the teeth. They were going to let Ralph ride to Shiring, but they were not taking any risks with him. There would be no escape this time, he realized. Then he looked again. The sheriff was here, but the other armed riders were not his deputies. They were Earl Rowland's men. And there was the Earl himself, black-haired and black-bearded, mounted on a grey charger. What was he doing here? Without dismounting, the Earl leaned down and handed a rolled sheet of parchment to John Constable.
"Read that, if you can," Roland said, speaking as always out of one side of his mouth. "It is a writ from the king. All the prisoners in the county are pardoned and freed, on condition they come with me to join the king's army."
Gerald shouted, "Hurrah!" Maud burst into tears. Merthyn looked over the constable's shoulder and read the writ. Ralph looked at Alan, who said,
"What does it mean?"
"It means we're free," Ralph said.
John Constable said,
"It does, if I read it aright."
He looked at the sheriff.
"Do you confirm this?"
"I do," said the sheriff.
"Then there is not more to be said. These men are free to go with the Earl."
The constable rolled up the parchment. Ralph looked at his brother. Merthyn was weeping. Were they tears of joy or frustration? He was given no more time to wonder.
"Come on," said Roland impatiently. "We've completed the formalities. Let's get on the road. The king is in France. We've a long way to go."
He wheeled his horse and rode down the main street. Ralph kicked Griff's sides, and the horse eagerly broke into a trot and followed the Earl. Chapter 41
"You can't win,"
Gregory Longfellow said to Prior Godwin, sitting in the large chair in the hall of the prior's house.
"The king is going to grant a borough charter to Kingsbridge."
Godwin stared at him. This was the lawyer who had won two cases for him at the royal court, one against the Earl and the other against the alderman. If such a champion declared himself beaten, then surely defeat must be inevitable. It was not to be borne. If Kingsbridge became a royal borough, the priory would be sidelined. For hundreds of years, the prior had ruled the town. In Godwin's eyes, the town existed only to serve the priory, which served God. Now the priory would become just part of a town ruled by merchants, serving the god of money, and the Book of Life would show that the prior who let this happen was Godwin. Dismayed, he said,
"Are you quite certain?"
"I'm always quite certain," said Gregory.
Godwin was aggravated. Gregory's cocksure attitude was all very well when he was sneering at your opponents, but when he turned it on you, it became infuriating. Angrily, Godwin said,
"You came all the way to Kingsbridge to tell me you can't do what I asked for?"
"And to collect my fee," Gregory said blithely. Godwin wished he could have him thrown into the fish pond in his London clothes. It was the Saturday of Whitsun weekend, the day before the opening of the Fleece Fair. Outside, on the green to the west of the cathedral, hundreds of traders were setting up their stalls, and their conversations and cries to one another combined to make a roar that could be heard here in the hall of the prior's house, where Godwin and Gregory sat at either end of the dining table. Philemon, sitting on the bench at the side, said to Gregory, "Perhaps you could explain to the Lord Prior how you have reached this pessimistic conclusion." He was developing a tone of voice that sounded half obsequious and half contemptuous. Godwin was not sure he liked it. Gregory did not react to the tone. "Of course," he said. "The king is in France." Godwin said, "He has been there for almost a year, but nothing much has happened. You will hear of action this winter."
"Why?"
"You must have heard of the French raids on our southern ports."
"I have," Philemon said.
"They say the French sailors raped nuns at Canterbury."
"We always claim the enemy has raped nuns," Gregory said with condescension. "It encourages the common people to support the war. But they did burn Portsmouth, and there has been serious disruption to shipping. You may have noticed a fall in the price you get for your wool."
"We certainly have. That's partly due to the difficulty of shipping it to Flanders, and the price you're paying for wine from Bordeaux is up for the same reason."
"We couldn't afford wine at the old prices," Godwin thought, but he did not say so.
Gregory went on. "These raids appear to be no more than preliminaries. The French are assembling an invasion fleet. Our spies say they already have more than 200 vessels anchored in the mouth of the Zwijn River."
Godwin noted that Gregory talked of our spies as if he were part of the government. In reality, he was only retailing gossip. All the same, it sounded convincing.
"But what does the French war have to do with whether or not Kingsbridge becomes a borough?"
"Taxes. The king needs money. The parish guild has argued that the town will be more prosperous, and therefore will pay more tax, if the merchants are freed from the control of the priory. And the king believes this. It has proved true before. That's why kings create boroughs. Boroughs generate trade, and trade produces tax revenue."
"Money, again," Godwin thought with disgust. "Is there nothing we can do?"
"Not in London. I advise you to concentrate on the Kingsbridge end. Can you persuade the parish guild to withdraw the application? What's the old alderman like? Can he be bribed?"
"My uncle Edmund? He's in poor health and fading fast. But his daughter, my cousin Caris, is the real driving force behind this."
"Ah, yes. I remember her at the trial. Rather arrogant, I felt."
"There was a case of the pot calling the kettle black," Godwin thought sourly.
"She's a witch," he said.
"Is she now? That might help."
"I didn't mean literally," Philemon said. "As a matter of fact, Lord Prior, there have been rumours."
Gregory raised his eyebrows.
"Interesting."
Philemon went on. "She is a great friend of a wise woman called Matty, who mixes potions for gullible townspeople." Godwin was about to pour scorn on the witchcraft idea. Then he decided to shut up. Any weapon that might shoot down the notion of a borough charter must surely have been sent by God. Perhaps Caris does use witchcraft, he thought. Who knows?
Gregory said, "I see you hesitate. Of course, if you are fond of your cousin."
"I was when we were younger," Godwin said, and he felt a pang of regret for the old simplicities. "But I regret to say she has not grown into a God-fearing woman."
"In that case,
I must investigate this," Godwin said. Gregory said, "If I might make a suggestion?" Godwin had had enough of Gregory's suggestions, but he did not quite have the nerve to say so.
"Of course,"
he said with slightly exaggerated politeness.
"Heresy investigations can be mucky.
You shouldn't get your own hands soiled, and people may be nervous about talking to a prior. Delegate the task to someone less intimidating. This young novice, for example." He indicated Philemon, who glowed with pleasure. "His attitude strikes me as sensible." Godwin recalled that it was Philemon who had discovered Bishop Richard's weakness, his affair with Marjorie. He was certainly the man for any dirty work.
"All right," he said. "See what you can find out, Philemon."
"Thank you, Lord Prior," said Philemon. "Nothing would give me more pleasure."
On Sunday morning, people were still pouring into Kingsbridge. Carys stood and watched them streaming over Merthyn's two wide bridges on foot, on horseback, or driving two-wheeled and four-wheeled horse carts and ox carts laden with goods for the fair. The sight gladdened her heart. There had been no grand opening ceremony. The bridge was not really finished, but was usable thanks to a temporary timber roadbed. But all the same, word had got around that it was open, and that the roads were safe from outlaws. Even Buonaventura Caroli was here. Merthyn had suggested a different way of collecting the tolls, which the parish guild had adopted eagerly. Instead of a single booth at the end of the bridge, creating a bottleneck, they had stationed 10 men on Leper Island in temporary booths spread across the road between the two bridges. Most people handed over their penny without breaking stride. "There isn't even a queue," Carys said aloud, talking to herself. And the weather was sunny and mild, with no sign of rain. The fair was going to be a triumph. Then, a week from today, she would marry Merthyn. She still had misgivings. The idea of losing her independence and becoming someone's property had not ceased to terrify her, even though she knew Merthyn was not the kind of man to take advantage by bullying his wife. On the rare occasions when she had confessed this feeling, to Gwenda, for example, or to Matty Wise, she had been told that she thought like a man. Well, so be it. That was how she felt. But the prospect of losing him had seemed even more bleak. What would she have left, except for a cloth manufacturing business that did not inspire her? When he finally announced his intention of leaving town, the future had suddenly seemed empty, and she had realized that the only thing worse than being married to him might be not being married to him. At least, that was what she told herself in her more positive moments. Then, sometimes, when she lay awake in the middle of the night, she saw herself backing out at the last minute, often in the middle of the wedding, refusing to take the vows and rushing out of the church, to the consternation of the entire congregation. That was nonsense, she felt now in the light of day, with everything going so well. She would marry Merthyn and be happy. She left the riverbank and walked through the town to the cathedral, already crowded with worshippers waiting for the morning service. She remembered Merthyn feeling her up behind a pillar. She felt nostalgic for the thoughtless passion of their early relationship, the long, intense conversations and the stolen kisses. She found him near the front of the congregation, studying the south aisle of the choir, the part of the church that had collapsed in front of their eyes 2 years ago. She recalled going up into the space over the vaulting with Merthyn, and overhearing that dreadful interaction between Brother Thomas and his estranged wife, the conversation that had crystallized all her fears and made her turn Merthyn down. She put the thought out of her mind. "The repairs seem to be holding," she said, guessing what he was thinking about. He looked dubious. 2 years is a short time in the life of a cathedral. There's no sign of deterioration. That's what makes it difficult. An invisible weakness can work away for years, unsuspected, until something comes tumbling down. Perhaps there is no weakness. There must be, he said with a touch of impatience. There was a reason why that collapse took place 2 years ago. We never found out what it was, so we haven't put it right. If it hasn't been put right, it's still a weakness. It might have corrected itself spontaneously. She was just being argumentative, but he took her seriously. Buildings don't usually repair themselves, but you're right. It's possible. There might have been some seepage of water, for example, from a blocked gargoyle, which somehow became diverted to a less harmful route. The monks began to enter in procession, singing, and the congregation went quiet. The nuns appeared from their separate entrance. One of the novice nuns looked up, a beautiful pale face in the line of hooded heads. It was Elizabeth Clark. She saw Merthyn and Carys together, and the sudden malice in her eyes made Carys shudder. Then Elizabeth bowed her head and disappeared back into her anonymous uniform. "She hates you," Merthyn said.
She thinks I stopped you marrying her.
She's right.
No, she's not. You could have married anyone you wanted.
But I only wanted you.
You toyed with Elizabeth.
It must have seemed